Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Talking France. Up for discussion this week are France's regional airports. How many of you have flown into or out of the likes of Limoges, Brest or even Bergerac? No doubt these airports are handy, but are they really sustainable going forward? We'll also look at how France's official champagne region is going to grow. Could it include part of England one day? And with the Olympics in sight, we'll explain, with the help of author Simon Cooper, how Paris and Parisians are changing. And can you really get €6,000 a month in unemployment benefit in France for a whole year? Yes, you can, but perhaps not for much longer with the French government under pressure to make cuts. And most of the deadly animals in France are in zoos. But the numbers of wolves and bears in the wild are growing. We'll look at where they are and the chances of you encountering one, plus a look at some of the other dangerous animals in France. I'm Ben McPartland, and with me once again will be the local Frances, Emma Pearson and Jen Mansfield, as well as our politics expert, John Litchfield. Let's get straight to it. Now, air travel has been on the rise in France, and recent reports have shown that we are nearing pre-pandemic levels of traffic going through French airports. But does that mean all of these airports are in good health? Before we answer that question, Jen, tell us a bit more about the country's many smaller regional airports. We know about the two ones in Paris, of course, and the big cities, but France has many more.
Yeah, if you've driven through France, you've probably noticed them because the country has a ton of airports. As of 2023, France was home to 73 mainland commercial airports, and that's not even counting all of the smaller aerodromes. In reality, it's the big airports, like you said, like Charles de Gaulle or Orly, that bring in over half of the country's air traffic. Meanwhile, the rest of the country's dozens of smaller regional airports are actually loss-making. In all, only about a quarter of those airports actually break even financially. According to a 2019 study on the airline industry in France, an airport needed at least 1 million passengers a year to be profitable. The vast majority of these small regional airports are well below that minimum.
Orly and CDG in Paris are obviously major hubs with well over 1 million passengers a year. But what about these other airports around France we're talking about, Jen? How many passengers are we talking about go through their departure gates?
Well, about half of those 73 airports had under 700,000 people traveling through per year. And some of them are really like super small, like Troyes, which had just about 1,562 passengers in 2023. But then others like Rodez had around 31,000 passengers. Castres got a bit more with about 36,000 passengers. Limoges was still a bit bigger. They got 264,000 passengers in 2023, but that's still quite small in comparison to the 10.8 million people that pass through the Marseille airport, for example. And some areas really have an abundance of these tiny regional airports, like Occitanie in southern France. That region is home to 9 of them, but really only 2 make up most of the traffic. So Toulouse Airport gets 71% of the passengers, Montpellier gets about 14% of the passengers, and then the other 7, so Carcassonne, Tarbes, Perpignan, Nîmes, Béziers, Rodez, and Castres, all of them combined make up that remaining 14%.
Now, those low numbers that you refer to, then they're the reason why these airports are in the news right now. How do they manage to stay in business with such low numbers of passengers?
Well, the short answer is that many of these airports are owned by local authorities and they rely heavily on government subsidies to stay afloat. The study on the aviation industry that I referenced earlier found that state and local authorities spend around 90 million euro a year to help these small to medium-sized airports just break even. And they also receive a portion of the funds from the airport tax, and that is paid by larger airports and then distributed back to some of the smaller ones. But that's mostly to help with like safety and security needs. On top of that, these small airports, they don't really have a lot of negotiation options. And so they find themselves competing with the neighboring airports that aren't too far away. And so they're forced to accept contracts with low-cost airlines. And as of 2021, low-cost air traffic represented more than 90% of the commercial traffic for the airports in Dole, Vatry, Limoges, Bergerac, Nîmes. And it represented all of the traffic at airports like Carcassonne, Tours, and Béziers.
Okay, so France with 73 airports. In comparison, the UK has only around 40 commercial airports, albeit France is well over double the size of the UK. Spain, perhaps a similar size to France, has around 50 functioning passenger airports. Why does France have so many airports to begin with, Jen?
Well, that's a good question. In the 20th century, there's a lot of investment in air travel. And historically, France has been a leader in the industry. Plus, a lot of France's now commercial airports were first used for military purposes and then converted to become commercial. But I always was taught about the Wright brothers in the U.S., but France actually has a lot of flight-related milestones. It was the Frenchman Louis Blériot who made the first airplane flight across the English Channel in 1909. And nowadays, France is also home to the Airbus headquarters. So as of 2020, the 4,480 companies that work in the French aerospace industry employ over 263,000 people. And that makes up about 4.3% of the country's GDP coming from the air transport sector and foreign tourists arriving by air. So it's a pretty important industry in France.
Okay, so importantly, what about the future, Jen? We've talked on this podcast before about how the French government has taken policies to encourage other forms of travel. What is the future of these small regional airports?
So France is definitely trying to make rail travel more attractive right now, obviously for environmental reasons. In 2021, the country passed a law banning domestic air links of less than 2 hours and 30 minutes if there is an alternative train option. But in reality, this law has really only banned three routes, the Orly-Bordeaux, Orly-Lyon, and Orly-Nantes. There doesn't really seem to be a strong political appetite for just getting rid of these small airports altogether. Well, especially because a lot of them have secondary purposes like military training or forest fire response. But places like Occitanie are looking to try and consolidate the commercial operations and streamline the management to a regional rather than a local level. So this would help avoid overlapping flights. So for example, a Pau Paris flight and a Tarbes Paris flight wouldn't take off at the same time, which seems very logical. But the real question is going to be in 2027, when the EU is set to examine public aid given to airports. And they're going to look at whether large subsidies given to airports constitutes unfair competition. So we'll really see what happens then.
Okay. I mean, look, as a passenger, these airports can be quite handy. We know a lot of our readers fly into different parts of France. I remember flying to Dinan with Ryanair, and you literally land and you walk straight out of this tiny airport building and you're kind of out of the airport straight away, completely in contrast to CDG and Orly. Emma, have you ever flown into any regional airports around France?
Yeah, a few. I mean, I used to live in Castres, and I have to say, in all that time, I never used the airport once because it was really just internal flights around France. I've been into Carcassonne a couple of times, and that's another one. It's literally just a shed. It's quite good to fly out of, though, because there's very minimal security and you basically just like sit in the cafe having like really nice croissants that they buy in from a local place. And when straight your flight is ready, they just come and tell you like come onto the flight now. So it's very different from going out
it
to Charles de Gaulle.
So different, yeah. Okay, so the future of these airports might be in doubt. Thank you, Jen. Let's move on to champagne. Champagne is one of France's oldest protected labels, with sparkling white wine only able to call itself champagne if it is produced in the correct area and manner and conforms to the AOC status. And the industry has its fair share of lawyers that go after any brands or people incorrectly using the champagne name. But some of these rules are due to be relaxed, and it's a decision that's being forced upon the protectors of champagne, Jen.
Yeah, the number of French communes that are allowed to produce champagne with the capital C is set to change by 2028, and it does have to do with climate change. The Champagne Wine Growers Union is calling it the biggest decision in the last 60 years with major financial stakes.
Wow. Okay, look, before we find out a bit more about climate change and this big decision, just remind us, Jen, about these labels and rules around champagne.
Okay, so first things first, champagne is an AOC, or Appellation Origine Contrôlée. And that means that traditional location and production techniques are crucial for qualifying to be able to use that name. And periodically, these AOCs are updated and reviewed, and that's what's happening with champagne right now. So as things stand, the champagne official brand can only be produced in 319 communes spreading over a space of 34,000 hectares in four départements, Marne, Haute-Marne, Aube, and Aisne. But by 2028, around 40 new municipalities could gain the right to produce wine within the Champagne appellation. And a few others might actually lose access to the special label too. We don't have a final idea of exactly which communes just yet, but the decision around revising the AOC Champagne label has been going on for several years now. And the goal is for the changes to be made official, hopefully by 2026 and at latest by 2028.
Okay, tell us a bit about the reason why they want to revise this label then.
A large part of it has to do with the demand for champagne. More and more people around the world just want to buy champagne. So adding more communes to the list will help increase the number of bottles that can be sold to meet that demand. But it also has to do with climate change. So the head of the Champagne Wine Growers Union, Maxime Tubach, told French media that the climate has changed over the last century, and there have also been mistakes and oversights. He said that the Wine Growers Union is working alongside a council of experts from the French government's labeling body, the INAO. That's the group that decides on the AOC and AOP labels to integrate the effects of climate change. He mentioned that these new parameters would take stock of certain plots that face the south and, for example, might suffer more from drought.
Jen, we've talked previously on the podcast about the impact of global warming, climate change on the French wine industry. It's happening now, is it?
Yeah, one of the primary issues is that winters are becoming warmer, and basically that means that the warmer wines will come out of their cold weather dormancy earlier, and then they become vulnerable to frost. So if you get a cold snap in early spring, you can see vines that are totally lost. We saw that in 2021. Bordeaux has also really struggled with a mildew issue, and that's been going on. It's going on currently, and it happened a lot last summer. Last summer specifically, 90% of vineyards struggled with some level of fungus on the vines, which was largely because of that hot weather and the quote-unquote unusual subtropical climate conditions. And basically, this makes it so that the humidity hangs in the air and the vine's leaves stay wet for a long part of the day. And then that leads to more mildew growing. And obviously, that affects how many grapes can be cultivated at the end of the day. But climate change is also changing the composition and the taste of wine. So warmer weather means more sugar, so sweeter wine on the whole, plus a higher alcohol content, actually. And in general, it goes beyond taste and the number of grapes that you can cultivate. I mean, wine growing regions themselves are shifting. Generally, the most successful vineyard and wine growing regions have been between the 30 to 50 degree latitude areas with warmer temperatures. But wine growing areas are moving further away from the equator, so north in the case of Europe.
And these French winemakers, they're already taking action, are they not? Is it true that they've started to buy up land in the southeast of England as temperatures rise, Jen?
Well, that is especially true when it comes to sparkling wines. RFI recently reported that the Pommery Champagne House has started working to produce English sparkling wines. They started that in 2014. And then in 2015, the Champagne House's president purchased 70 hectares in Kent to take advantage of the UK's quote unquote increasingly temperate climate. You know, we should mention that there is a thriving wine industry in the southeast of England, but what they're making is English sparkling wine, not champagne.
Okay, but if the champagne area is expanding, are we going to start drinking British champagne one day?
Well, not super soon. Jean-Marc Tuzard, who's the director of a French public research institute that's dedicated to agricultural science, he told the French press that production conditions in Champagne will remain favorable until 2050, even if changes are coming.
Okay, on the subject of changes, let's talk about Paris, the French capital. It's been undergoing significant changes. Anyone who's visited in recent months will probably have noticed. Anyone living here definitely has. It's changing to the point where some of the many clichés about Paris that have been written and regurgitated over years may no longer be true. With the Olympics on the horizon, close observers say the city is full of optimism. It's greener, perhaps even cleaner, at least the air. It's even more international, and whisper it quietly, the locals appear happier to speak English. One author even said Paris was, quote, approaching a new zenith of glorious livability. That author was Simon Cooper, a columnist for the Financial Times, and he's got a new book out about Paris called Impossible City, Paris in the 21st Century. So I asked Simon about how Paris and Parisians were changing.
One big change, maybe since the pandemic, is people have become nicer. With the pandemic, it was a moment for a reset in all sorts of ways. And I found that especially younger people, they smile. They're much quicker to use to the familiar form of address. And the kind of older codes of the city began to collapse, the kind of formality, the standoffishness. Mm. The other change also with the pandemic is cycling. So I think there's now 50% more bikes than cars in Paris, of which I'm one. And it works brilliantly in Paris because it's quite a small city and it's pretty flat, most of it. And it's too small for cars. It's made for bicycles. But at the moment, what you have is this complete chaos, this kind of Brazilian-style traffic scene of everybody just breaking all the rules. But it sort of works.
Do you think we'll get it? You know, do you think Paris will become a kind of safe cycling city? People talk about Copenhagen. Paris modeled a lot of its cycling infrastructure on Copenhagen. Do you think it'll become like that, or Parisians is just never going to be like that?
I grew up in Holland cycling 40 years ago as a kid at school. Everyone in my class did. And that was sane and safe cycling. And I just think Parisians are too anarchic ever to do that.
Yeah.
But I think gradually the system will become saner and, you know, there'll be fines, for example, for running over pedestrians, which happens every day. Yeah.
Getting back to Parisians, and you mentioned that they're slightly nicer than they used to be. The coat is fallen away. What about their attitude towards English? I notice a lot of Parisians, young Parisians particularly, just kind of openly speaking English as soon as they hear that I'm an Anglophone in a cafe, switching straight away to English, which goes against the cliche we've got of Parisians not wanting to speak any kind of English.
Absolutely. I mean, the taboo on English has really collapsed in the 20 years that I've been here. And so now speaking English is a sign of being modern in the view of, say, Parisians under 40. And you see it in Macron's government. So, I mean, I think Macron speaks excellent English, but several other ministers do as well, are pretty bilingual. And so I think now to speak English is considered here a sign of strength and modernity. And also, there's just way more international, shall we say, in the city than there were 20 years ago. It's becoming a little bit more of a cosmopolitan city. I mean, my model is cities like Amsterdam or Copenhagen, which are effectively bilingual. English use is just considered completely normal in business and in life. Here, it's not at that level, but it's moving that way.
Do you think Anne Hidalgo, I remember saying, you know, she didn't really want Paris to become like London or New York in terms of like a 24-hour city where shops open all the time. Is it becoming like that, or is there still a resistance there in terms of kind of the commercial aspect of this city?
I mean, shop opening hours are more restricted here. I think the anxiety, so London for the people who run Paris is a model, but it's also a warning. It's a utopia and a dystopian one. And the utopia is London is a more cosmopolitan city. It has long had a more vibrant economy. Paris wants some of that, and it wants to grab business from London post-Brexit, but it also doesn't want to become what London has become, which is a kind of haven for footloose foreign money and for billionaires from everywhere who've driven up prices. So Paris wants the success of London without London's prices, and that's a very hard balance to achieve.
And another comparison with London, obviously this brings us on to the Olympic Games, which are going to be held this year in Paris. Huge, huge event. Do you think the Olympics will change Paris even further? Will there be a long-lasting impact on the city, on the people?
I don't think the Olympics themselves are going to be transformative. Paris is simply too significant a city to need the Olympics to brand or change it. And it's building very, very little new stuff for the Olympics. I think only the aquatic centre is the only new sports facility, plus the athletes' village. So really, I think the Olympics is a very fearful moment for Paris because of the risk of terrorism, risk of strikes. And the transformation is going to come through the 68 metro stations that they're building in the suburbs. I mean, just imagine that in London or New York for a moment, 68 new stations. And that is going to transform the city and the region much more than the Olympics.
Those metro stations are obviously outside of Paris in what we call the banlieue, slightly kind of derogatory term that's been used over the years by Parisians to kind of separate the suburbs of Paris from the city itself. Do you think the Olympics then and the Grand Paris project, you know, all this new transport links will help Parisians finally accept the suburbs to be part of their city and not see this distinction?
I mean, I think the word Paris is always going to connote this picture postcard city inside the périph, the one that everybody knows from a million images. But I think we're moving more towards an idea of what the French call the région parisienne or the Île-de-France, which connotes the wider region of 12 million people. So if you think there's only about 2 million people who live in Paris, 10 million in the suburbs. So the suburbs, the banlieue, even without Paris itself, are the biggest metropolitan area in the European Union, bigger than London also. And I think that what's going to happen is we're going to think more in terms of we live in the Parisian region than we live in Paris itself. And there'll be much more to-ing and fro-ing and much easier to go and see people for work, for pleasure in the banlieue, in Paris, wherever.
Thanks, Simon. Let's bring in someone else who knows a bit about Paris. John Litchfield. John, you've lived here for many years. How's the city and its inhabitants changed in your eyes?
Yeah, I've been living more in Normandy now, but sort of living in Paris off and on since 97, 98. And I lived here before in the late 70s. It's actually 50 years exactly since I first came to Paris as a teenager with my Belgian godmother. And I was amazed how dirty and dark Paris looked when I arrived, thinking it was the city of light. In the 60s, it was a very dark city. None of the buildings had been cleaned as such. It reminded me of the north of England where I came from, you know, even more scruffy than towns like Manchester in some ways, which is not at all what I expected from Paris. When I came back in the 70s, it was a very, very interesting city in the 70s, still quite gritty, you know, not as divided now between the sort of very rich areas and the sort of very small amount of poor working class areas that still exist up in the northeast corner, I suppose, mostly. But, you know, then it was a much more mixed city. And I think one of the reasons was that there were people of all kinds living in almost every part of the city, because there were people living in Chambre de Bonne above very wealthy apartments. And so you had a sense of it being a very varied, a very mixed, a very exciting city, which I think has been taken away in recent years. It's become a duller, much more tourist-friendly city, a more museum city than it used to be. That is changing again, maybe a little. And obviously now the new changes with the bike lanes, which are much disputed, but also attempts by the town hall to get sort of poorer people back into the city by having more social housing. So yeah, I think the answer is Paris is always changing. You know, it isn't a fixed a target. It isn't as people imagine it to be ever. And yet it remains always a very beautiful city, a very interesting city. I think it's lost some of its character in the last 20 years, but maybe, hopefully, that can be regained.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Simon. Emma, Jen, anything you've noticed about how Paris is changing? For me, I think it's just the number of international food outlets, restaurants that you can see here that's totally grown in recent years. Jen, Emma?
I would say on the topic of food, I've noticed that there are a lot more North American food brands in grocery stores. Like, I used to really struggle to find black beans, and I still do a bit, but like they're more present and that's only in the last 5 years. So that is definitely shifting.
Emma?
Well, I mean, I've only been here since 2019, so it's not that long a period, but certainly some of the sort of the things that people regularly trot out about Paris, I don't really recognize, like the grumpy waiters refusing to speak English. That's just not been my experience of Paris. But I also think that a lot of the time when particularly foreign observers are talking about Paris, what they're really talking about is what they call les beaux quartiers, the central areas that are very historic, that have a lot of wealthy people living in them. And I mean, I don't think the experience of the people living there has ever been true for the whole of Paris. You know, Paris is a very diverse place. There are people who are rich, there are people who are not rich. So looking just at those areas is a bit like looking at, what's that reality TV show called, Made in Chelsea, and deciding this is all Londoners, or like deciding that Sex and the City represents everyone who lives in New York. It's not really a true picture, and I don't think it ever has been.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Jen. Thanks, John, and thanks, Simon. If listeners want to read more from Simon, his book, Impossible City, Paris in the 21st Century, will be published on April the 11th and is available on hardback, ebook, and audiobook. So France's generous state benefits, especially unemployment benefits, are in the news because the government has said it wants to cut them in order to tackle the budget deficit we talked about last week. Before we get into what the government is going to cut and whether it's going to provoke angry protests on the streets, let's just look at how generous the employment benefit system, or assurance chômage as it's called, can be in France. Emma, can I really get 6,000 euros a month on chômage for a year?
Well, the short answer is yes, technically, but it's pretty unlikely. So in most countries, there is just a flat rate for benefit payments and everyone gets the same. But the French system works on a percentage of what you were earning before you lost your job. So there's a few sort of extra tweaks to this calculation. But the headline figure is that you get 57% of your former salary based on your average salary over the previous 12 months, up to a maximum of 6,615 euro per month. So yes, technically, it is possible to get 6,000 a month on unemployment benefits. But in order to get that, you would have had to have been earning more than 10,000 euro a month previously in order to get that. Okay. So I'm not sure this podcast is quite at the stage where we pay ourselves that just yet. So not now.
Not yet.
And actually only 0.05% of beneficiaries of chômage get that maximum amount. The average payout is 1,020 euro a month. And actually half of all recipients get less than 860 euro a month.
Okay, these benefits, payouts, they do come with certain rules and restrictions though, yeah?
Yeah, it does. I mean, after 12 months, that amount starts to be reduced, and that's what the government wants to reduce even further. But the big thing is you also need to be able to qualify for chômage in the first place. It's not paid out to everybody. And in order to qualify, there are sort of various conditions, which includes how you left your previous job. You need to have been either made redundant or had a contract ending. You can't just walk out one day. Mm. And you also need to have worked in France for at least 6 months out of the previous 12 to qualify. And this last one can be particularly tricky for foreigners. So like if you move to France for a job and then your company goes bust and you're left unemployed, you know, through no fault of your own, you can end up with nothing on chômage. And I actually saw that the place where I worked before here. The company went bust, we all got made redundant, and there were some people who'd recently moved over from Ireland and ended up qualifying for nothing. So that can be tricky for foreigners. And I mean, I think it is also important to point out that people who've worked in France, they've paid into this system. If you check your payslip every month, among the many, many deductions of stuff that goes out is assurance chômage, which is basically sort of unemployment insurance.
Yep.
So anyone who was earning enough to qualify for that 6,000 euro a month payment will have paid a lot into the system over the years. And there have also been several reforms of unemployment benefits in recent years, cutting time, including the maximum amount that's paid for, expanding the qualifying period, as well as also sort of requiring people who are on chômage to have more appointments at the job centre, take more training courses, and generally just show that they're trying to find a job. It's got a lot less generous in recent years. And I mean, it's kind of like a lot of French benefits. You know, you can always find examples where it's really, really generous, but they're almost always the exception rather than a rule. As I said, half of all benefits claimants in France get less than 860 euro a month, which is not a lot to live on, especially if you're living in an expensive city like Paris.
Nevertheless, Emma, this model is very different from many countries, including the UK, where you get a kind of set amount, a low amount, compared to the numbers you've talked about. And I think if you have any savings, you probably won't even get that. What is the philosophy behind this French model?
Well, I mean, the basic philosophy underpinning it is a practical one. It basically enables you to maintain something approaching your previous lifestyle while you search for a job. So, for example, you should be able to stay in your current home. You won't immediately have to move to somewhere cheaper. So, you know, if you have kids, you won't have to make them move schools. You know, all these things can have very disruptive effects on people's lives and can actually end up costing the state money as well.
Okay, let's go back to these cuts proposed by the government. It's not just to unemployment benefit either. Run us through them, Emma.
Yeah, so the finance minister, Bruno Le Maire, he will, on April 17th, present to ministers a package of cuts, which he's called the Programme de Stabilité. This is in order to tackle France's ballooning budget deficit. We talked about it in more detail last week, but the TLDR is that France is spending more than it earns. Le Maire and President Emmanuel Macron have already ruled out raising taxes, although they are actually talking about the possibility of a windfall tax on energy companies. But it basically means that savings will have to be made in spending, and that'll probably be in health and social costs, since these make up the bulk of French state spending. And we don't have full details of these yet. Like I said, they're being presented in a couple of weeks, but there are a few things that have been kind of trailed in advance to French media. And they include cuts to unemployment benefit, as we said.
Yep.
There has already been quite a lot of tinkering to this system since 2017. But what Le Maire has said he's looking to do is shortening the 12-month period that people receive that maximum benefit. Both he and Macron are hoping that this will help with the budget deficit, but they're also hoping that it will help France to achieve its goal of full employment by 2027. This goal had been roughly on track because unemployment in France has been slowly but steadily falling in recent years, but it now appears to have stagnated. So they're kind of hoping that might help with that as well. The other things that they're looking at is health costs. So the out-of-pocket cost for medical appointments and prescriptions has already doubled this year. It used to be 50 centimes that you paid yourself, and now it's a euro. And it kind of seems that cuts to other sort of health-adjacent services are being considered. So, for example, the free patient transport services, which in most cases like a free taxi ride to medical appointments, to non-emergency appointments, that is, that's being considered to be at least trimmed, if not cut entirely. They're also looking at the system of the arrêt de travail, which is like a sick leave. Taking sick leave is sort of looked at an area where savings could be made. So maybe cuts to the rate of sick pay, as well as cuts to the daily allowance of people with long-term medical conditions. And the other area where savings are likely to come from is local government and state-funded bodies. So Le Maire said that all branches of government need to carefully examine their finances. And he's also said he'll be writing to state-funded organisations, of which there are a lot in France, such as the Centre National de Cinéma, for example, or Business France, which is the business organisation, asking them to prepare budget savings plans.
Okay, this is a good time to bring in John Litchfield again here to find out if we are heading for people on the streets with these cuts. Firstly, John, though, is France's social spending just too generous to the point it can't afford it?
Well, I don't think that is true, in the sense that one thing that's not often pointed out is that the unemployment pay is not a huge component in the welfare budget in France, which is huge. It's something like a third of GDP goes on welfare payments of one kind or another, pensions, health and so on. But unemployment pay only counts for about 6%. So it's not a huge component in that. And even Bruno Le Maire, the finance minister, says that the planned reform of which is the fourth that's been done in the Macron years of the unemployment system is not about cutting the deficit, which is an issue, as you know, at the moment, but that's not why they're doing it. It's more about trying to get people back into employment and reaching Macron's very ambitious target now of having full employment by 2027, full employment being defined as about 5 or 5.5% of the workforce, whereas France is now on about 7.2%, I think. So they're saying it's about that rather than about cutting public spending, but obviously that is a consideration as well.
John, nevertheless, it's a sensitive subject. Can you see unions mobilising workers against any proposed changes, cuts, reforms to the unemployment system?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that if it does come to a big full-scale change in the unemployment system as proposed by the government, you'll see the same kinds of protests you saw against pension reform, maybe even more virulent and violent. The problem, though, is I think that, you know, unemployment pay is not controlled directly by the government, or the unemployment system is not controlled directly by the government, like many things in the welfare system. It's managed nominally, at least, or actually in many senses, by the unions and by the bosses. And that goes right back to the welfare state that was created after the Second World War. The government can change the parameters, it can change the laws, but it has to do so in consultation with the unions and the bosses. And so it's going to be a very complex negotiation. It has to get also through the National Assembly, where it doesn't have a majority. You know, it seems to me rather strange that the government is looking for this confrontation at the moment when it has many other issues to deal with. It has a very difficult European election coming up. It's not going to make enormous difference on the deficit. It's arguable whether it's going to make a difference on unemployment. You know, if you look at the very generous countries that provide very generous unemployment in Europe, like Denmark, unemployment pay in Europe, like Denmark, their unemployment rate is much lower than France's, at about 4.2%, as is Britain's, which proposes very, very mean unemployment pay. Yeah. So is unemployment pay and the conditions for unemployment what causes unemployment to be high? It's not a very simple argument to make, I think, that one.
Thanks, John. Emma, just finally, you're a fan of the French social model, aren't you?
I am, yes. The basic bargain is that when you're working, a hefty slice of your income disappears into the French tax system every month. And in exchange for that, the state is there for you when you need it. And the basic principle is that if something goes wrong, you know, if you get sick, if you lose your job, the state will help you out until you can get back on your feet. And the state is also by your side through, you know, more everyday experiences. If you have kids, the state will provide schooling for them, subsidised childcare, lots of extra services. The state will help you keep fit and healthy. The state will help you travel around France. And if you want to improve your professional or your personal skills, then the state will help you out with that too. I don't think it's a perfect system at all. There are mistakes. There are wasteful areas. There are people who pull through the cracks. But for me, the basic idea of everybody paying out to help their neighbours, fraternité, as we call it in the French motto, doesn't seem like a bad idea.
That sounded like basically a rehearsal of your French citizenship interview. You just need to do it in French now.
Yeah, okay.
You totally rehearsed that, haven't you? You copy that from your scripts for the citizenship interview. Thanks, Emma. Great defence of the French social model. Thanks, John. Final segment, guys. It's a very important one. I'm passionate about this. Simple question. Do I need to worry about bears and wolves if I'm in the French countryside? Who's going to answer that? Go on, Emma.
Well, yes, bears and wolves exist in France. They've been reintroduced since they were hunted almost to extinction in the 20th century. They've been reintroduced since the 1990s, and they seem to be settling in quite well. Wolves now have an habitual presence in around half of French departments, and the most recent figures from the Pyrenees, which were released this week, show a small but steady increase in the number of brown bears living there. There are now thought to be 83 bears living in the mountains.
Wow, so, wolves in half French departments, that's a lot.
It has been controversial in some ways. Farmers in particular are unhappy about wolves preying on their sheep. But there have been very few reported problems with hikers, cyclists or other countryside users. Mm. Basically, you're fairly unlikely to see either a wolf or a bear if you're out and about in the French countryside. And if you do, it's probably likely to try and avoid contact with you, as I do, in fact.
Can't play fetch the stick with a wolf, can you?
No, they're not. Right. They don't love that.
Okay, that's a relief. But are there other wild animals or even farm animals in France that people out hiking could run into and end up in a bit of a scrape?
Well, wild boar are pretty common in the French countryside. They're less timid than wolves or bears, but they don't usually seek out contact with people. But you do need to be careful if you're driving at night, because if you hit one, you're likely to write off your car. You're probably likely to write off the boar as well, but you're also likely to seriously damage your car. And deer as well, actually, in rural areas. You need to be really careful if you're driving at night. But actually, the sort of the bigger dangers of the French countryside are a lot smaller. Right now, it's the start of tick season. You need to watch out for ticks, both on yourself and your pets, if you've been out and about in rural areas. They can cause health problems. Every year, around 30,000 people contract Lyme disease after being bitten by a tick, which can cause sort of long-term health problems.
Do you know what you need if you get bitten by a tick? You need a what's called a tire tick, which is a pull tick in French. Yeah. You get it from the pharmacy. You've got to twist them out.
Ugh.
I found a few of them on the kids. You can't leave the heads in, apparently. That's dangerous. You've got to twist them out.
When I was a kid, you always had to put a little match underneath it because then it would entice the tick to exit you on its own.
Ooh, sounds dangerous, that, Jen. Okay, Emma, off you go. Continue. Things are going to get worse, aren't they, with rising temperatures?
Rising temperatures we talked about earlier, they're responsible for two newcomers into France, Asian hornets and tiger mosquitoes. Mm. Frelons asiatiques, as they call the Asian hornets, they're actually more dangerous to bees than to people. They've been decimating French bee populations, but they can give a nasty sting, and they're responsible for around 5 deaths a year, mostly for people who have an allergy to stings. Meanwhile, the stripy black and white tiger mosquito, they can spread diseases, including dengue fever and Zika. These diseases, they can be fatal. It's fairly rare if you're lucky enough to have access to good healthcare. But tiger mosquitoes have been steadily moving north as the weather gets warmer. And this year, for the first time, they've been reported in Normandy. So they've kind of got to the top of France now. And the other really annoying thing about them is they come out in the day as well as the night. So there's kind of no escape from the horrible little stripy twats.
Do you really want to call them twats?
I hate them. Mosquitoes love me. I hate them. And talking of stings, warming seas mean that jellyfish are getting a lot more common than they used to be. And species like the Portuguese man of war can give you a very painful and actually potentially fatal sting as well.
Mm. If strikes in the Olympics haven't put our listeners off coming to France, this segment certainly has. I can feel they're cancelling their trips, but... last of all, what is the most dangerous animal of all in France, Emma?
Well, statistically, that would be cows. They are responsible for about a dozen deaths a year in France. That doesn't actually mean that cows are particularly aggressive, but it's just that you're more likely to encounter a cow because they're pretty common. And people tend to not take care around cows because, you know, they don't have the same scary reputation as wolves do. The most common victims of cows are farm workers, but you should be careful if you're walking near them in the countryside, especially if you have a dog, because if the dog chases the cow and causes it to panic, they can attack, and they do kill some people. So be careful in the countryside.
Thanks, Emma. I think the scariest animal I saw in France was a patou. Do you know what a patou is?
Oh, is it one of those like wolf dogs?
I'm not sure wolf dog is the proper name, but it's a dog that protects the sheep from the wolf, and it's massive, and there's signs everywhere in the Alps on the paths. Just if you see a patou, just give it a wide one.
They look really, really
they
cute.
They look lovely,
They're all fluffy, and you kind of want to pet them, but they're vicious killers.
No, stay away, Jen, you're waving your finger furiously at me.
Well, yes, because I'm also terrified of these dogs. And I actually like...
a patou.
Yeah. I like that. I like dogs. But I went hiking in the Pyrenees and there were all these signs that were about, beware of the sheepdogs. And we ended up visiting a family that had some of the sheepdogs in their yard. And they were saying that they're so aggressive with people that they let them out of the house like early in the morning with the one person that tends to the dogs and then late at night with that one person so they don't come in contact with any other people.
Yeah, they're not like the sheepdogs, the black and white ones, the border collie kind of sheepdogs, aren't they? The big...
No, they roam. They roam the mountains with the animals.
But their job is to protect the sheep from the wolves. Exactly, so they've got to be fierce enough to take on a wolf if necessary. So they're quite ferocious.
Yeah, the advice that we got was, especially if you're hiking with a dog, to keep your dog close by, because that's usually when people run into issues, is if their dog runs off and then disturbs the pack of sheep and then causes a fight.
Interesting. Great advice for our listeners there. Thanks, John. Thanks, Simon. Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Jen. That brings us to the end of this week's episode. I'll put a load of related articles in the show notes and the podcast articles, so do check them out on website, and we'll be back with more next week. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.